Brothers and sisters, if you don't change your ways, you are on the road to Jam Nation.
Editorial note, this episode was originally published to Spotify on May 21st, 2023, and has now since been re-edited to replace full songs with song clips in order to publish this on other streaming services beyond Spotify. There may be references in this episode to events and dates that well precede the episode publish date on any podcasting platforms that are not Spotify. And there may be references to songs which have since been replaced by song clips. I just don't want anybody to be confused. Now, let's move on to the episode. Enjoy! Welcome, everybody, to episode 25 of Road to Jam Nation. In this episode, I begin my new countdown project, which features the albums of 1987. And this will be the first episode of this podcast that does one of these yearly listening projects uniquely for this audience, whereas my previous episodes had all featured analysis and commentary that I had originally prepared on my social media platform. For 1987, I think I did the deepest dive yet into the various musical genres of the year. 1987, to me, was an era that was dominated by the sounds of what was often being called heartland rock, a style of rock music that was meant to appeal to the sort of blue-collar average Joes populating middle America. It was basic, straightforward rock music, with some hints of country and folk influences. There were a ton of releases in 1987 in this style. And the fad had largely been kicked off due to the massive popularity and commercial success of Bruce Springsteen's music earlier in the decade. I started this episode off by playing one of the songs off of Bruce Springsteen's 1987 album, Tunnel of Love. Indeed, I played the actual title cut from that album. Tunnel of Love was an album that I personally loved back in 1987. I really liked the change of pace of the album, which had Bruce Springsteen in a more self-reflective mode and stripped of the full strength of his E Street Band collaborators after the huge anthemic nature of his Born in the USA album. Tunnel of Love still got serious consideration for a spot in my top 20, but ultimately, while I did like that album quite a bit at the time, I wound up cutting it, largely because I don't think that the mid-80s production style on that album has dated all that well. And indeed, I've often criticized the production values on many Bruce Springsteen albums that were released after the mid-80s. He's simply gone in a different direction with his production than what tends to appeal to my ears. The heavy use of drum machines and synthesizers of the 80s vintage that appear on the Tunnel of Love album have made the music on the album sound a bit tired and dated to me. And so, re-listening to this album for the first time in quite a while, I found that I just wasn't enjoying it the way that I used to, so it wound up not making my top 20 list. Some other major albums that I would classify into the heartland rock style that got cut for the year also included Tom Petty's album, Let Me Up, I've Had Enough. On this album, Tom Petty and his Heartbreakers band attempted to capture the energy of their live sound in the studio. And I think they do largely succeed at that, although they delivered that for an album that I don't think was quite as deep in strong songwriting as most of the best Petty albums tend to be. So Let Me Up, I've Had Enough wound up being a very good performance of a lot of rather second-tier Tom Petty songs, and so that album didn't make my top 20 list either.
You're killing me.
Bryan Adams may have been a Canadian, but his music was very much being marketed to this same Heartland rock market. In 1987, brought out Bryan Adams' new album, Into the Fire, which was the follow-up album to his massive 1984 hit album, Reckless. Into the Fire failed to continue that same level of huge success, though it was still a platinum seller, and would rise to number 2 on the album charts. The album contained the number 6 pop hit, Heat of the Night, as well as 2 other songs that hit the lower levels of the pop charts. Into the Fire was savaged by critics at the time, who complained of the many cliches that Bryan Adams uses in his songwriting. And I can't personally say that I disagree with those criticisms when I listen to this music. I was never a huge Bryan Adams fan. The Hooters were a band from Philadelphia, and the band's music contained heavy influences from Celtic folk, as well as from ska, in the band's overall folk rock type of sound. The Hooters were marketed towards the Heartland rock audience as well, and they had achieved success with their second album in 1985, which had gone double platinum status and produced 3 moderate hits for the band. The Hooters released their third album in 1987, One Way Home, and the band was able to ride their existing momentum well enough for One Way Home to gain gold-level status itself, despite the fact that none of the 4 singles from this album made it onto the pop charts at all. He's chosen you to do his will. You can spread the word and you're cooked to bill. The Bodines were a band out of Wisconsin, and they had released their debut album in 1986, and they followed that debut up quickly in 1987 with their second album, Outside Looking In. But despite heavy promotion at the band's start, the Bodines never really achieved major mainstream success. They mostly stayed a niche band with a loyal regional following in the Midwest. Outside Looking In contained 2 of the band's 5 singles that got moderate airplay on rock radio. But the band's only crossover pop hit wouldn't come until 1993, when the band would provide the theme song for a TV show at that time, with that song becoming a decent-sized pop hit as well. Less well-remembered was a band called The Brandos, who released their debut album in 1987, Honor Among Thieves. The Brandos' song Gettysburg did get moderate radio play, but the band never really broke big and ultimately wound up being more successful in Europe than they ever were in America. Fabulous Thunderbirds were a blues rock band that had enjoyed big crossover success with their 1986 album, Tough Enough. And and the band quickly followed that up with a new album in 1987 called Hot Number. Hot Number would continue a little bit of the momentum from the band's breakthrough, although the biggest song on this album, Stand Back, only made it to number 76 on the pop charts.
If you want something bad enough, you got to stick to it. Ain't nobody telling me that I can't do it. Don't let no one tell you what you should be. Nobody in this world can say no to me.
Stand back.
I'm coming through.
Stand back.
I know just what to do.
Stand back.
Let me make my way.
Stand back.
This isn't the word I say.
Charlie Daniels had begun his career as a Southern rock performer in the 1970s, before transitioning to more of an outlaw country style. But in 1987, Charlie Daniels released his album Powder Keg, which sounds like it was an attempt to cash in on this heartland rock sound. It didn't work artistically or commercially for him. Powder Keg would be the only Charlie Daniels album of the 1980s to not chart at all on the country albums chart. And it also didn't dent the overall Billboard Top 200 either. So his attempt at once again broadening his fan base had failed. The Heartland rock fad wound up being attractive to a number of other previously established artists to try and tap into. Peter Wolf, the former lead singer for the Jay Giles Band, had a natural affinity for this style of rootsy rock music. And the title track of his second solo album, Come As You Are, which was released in 1987, wound up becoming a good-sized pop hit for Peter Wolf, as well as a number one song on rock radio.
There'll be a hot time, at the Lakeside Ferry, and the boys are throwing it for free. We'll jump the moon, take it for a joyride. I still get up there for you and me. Come as you are, now come on. Come as you are, we'll have a ball. Ain't gonna be no masquerade.
Ry Cooder had spent his music career as something of a musical chameleon. But his 1987 album, Get Rhythm, was certainly aimed directly at that heartland sound, with the title song being a cover of Johnny Cash's old rockabilly hit, and the rest of the album falling very much in line with that sort of sound. And then there was the 1987 Dan Fogelberg album Exiles. To me, the production on this album seems designed to target that heartland rock market. Although ultimately, the songs on this album wound up achieving much more success on Fogelberg's traditional easy listening audience than it did at attracting any of the heartland rock fans.
She got a trail of broken hearts behind her, like the shadow and the shadows cast. Ain't the first one and I doubt that I'll be the last.
Blue-eyed soul singer and blues rocker Joe Cocker got heavy airplay on rock radio with the title song of his 1987 album, Unchain My Heart. This song was a cover of an old Ray Charles hit, and the album that contained it wound up being nominated for a Grammy, though it didn't ultimately win.
Unchain my heart.
Unchain my heart.
Hollywood star Bruce Willis seemed to be trying to mimic the style of Joe Cocker when he released The Return of Bruno in 1987. The Return of Bruno was preceded the prior year by the single Respect Yourself, which was a cover of a great song by the Staples Singers that Bruce Willis absolutely butchers. But despite that, his version of it wound up being a top five hit for him anyway, mostly due to his massive showbiz popularity at the time. The rest of the Return of Bruno album is even worse than that hit song. Bruce Willis was surrounded by grade A musical talent for this album, but the problem was he couldn't sing worth a damn. It's basically just all about the novelty of a big movie star doing a campy approximation of Blue-Eyed Soul. I was not a fan at the time, and it sounds even worse to me now. T-Bone Burnett is a massively successful music producer who has also had tremendous success working in the film industry on soundtracks and musical scores. T-Bone Burnett has produced a lot of outstanding albums by acts with Heartland-style music, as well as broader styles than that. And he also records music himself, including his 1987 album, The Talking Animals. The Talking Animals has a lot of very well-executed music, but the songwriting isn't particularly noteworthy.
She slides across the floor.
John Hiatt released one of his best albums in 1987, Bring the Family. This album included his original version of the song Thing Called Love, which would later become a hit for Bonnie Raitt, and the album also contained his outstanding song Have a Little Faith in Me, which bizarrely was never actually released as a single, but over time has become one of Hiatt's best-known songs anyway.
When the tears you cry are all you can believe, just give these loving arms a try, baby, and have a little faith in me, and have a little faith in me.
Among the godfathers of the Heartland rock style of music would be The Band. And 1987 saw the debut solo album finally come out from the main songwriter for that great classic band, Robbie Robertson. Robbie Robertson's self-titled debut is an excellent sequence of memorable and engaging songs, and the album was a very difficult cut for me from my top 20. It certainly would make a list of top 25 if I extended my list a little bit more. The hit song off of this album was Somewhere Down That Crazy River, with the singer from the Bodines on guest vocals, Sam Yannis. But for the musical example for this album, I prefer to play the great song Broken Arrow. Broken Arrow would later be covered by Rod Stewart and become a hit for him. And the song was also covered by the Grateful Dead with their bass player Phil Lesh on lead vocals during the last few years of the Grateful Dead's existence. And Phil has continued to occasionally cover this song with his solo bands in the years since the Grateful Dead dissolved. Let's play a little bit of Robbie Robertson's original version of it now. Here's Broken Arrow. Enjoy! While a lot of singer-songwriters were being encouraged to adapt their style to the Heartland rock fad, there were still plenty of established performers who just kept following their own unique muses. Some of the interesting folk and blues flavors releases for the year that I didn't think had a style that fell into the Heartland Rock category included new but fairly forgettable albums by traditional folk artists like Joan Baez, John Fahey, and Van Morrison doing what Van Morrison does with his album Poetic Champions Compose, which is perfectly enjoyable and interesting like most Van Morrison albums, but certainly is not among Morrison's most memorable albums.
You're the queen of the slipstream, without the chance. You will cross many waters to hear. You will drink of the fountain of innocence. You'll experience the long, cool winter here. There's a dream where the contents.
Taj Mahal released the album Taj in 1987, which has Taj Mahal delivering music with his typical engaging calypso-tinged folk blues sound. But man, that 1980s production style on the album really makes it sound pretty second-rate these days, despite the host of outstanding musicians that Taj Mahal had involved for the recording of this album.
Oh, I'm about to play spring insecticide by the other day. And a couple of school and children at 3 o'clock in a way. All over the island.
The most outlier and hard to categorize singer-songwriter, as usual, though, was Tom Waits, who released his latest album, Frank's Wild Years, in 1987. Frank's Wild Years contains songs that Tom had written for a play by the same name. So while there are some typically great Tom Waits performances and lyric craft on this album, there's also a lot of songs on it that just don't seem to work that great to me when separated from the play that they were intended for. So I don't think that Frank's Wild Years is nearly as strong as Waits' prior two albums, 1985's Rain Dogs and 1983's Swordfish Trombones. But let's listen to one of the better songs off that album anyway. This song is Cold Cold Ground by Tom Waits. Enjoy!
Crestfallen, sad, kicking an old cafe. Never slept with a dream before you had to go away. There's a bell in the tower, Uncle Ray brought around. Don't worry about the army in the cold, cold ground. Cold, cold ground. Cold, cold ground.
So having started off this episode with a discussion of Heartland Rock, I should note that country music had, of course, long been the typical musical voice of the American heartland. But there was obviously a feeling at the time that the Nashville elite weren't adequately addressing that marketplace anymore. As music moved towards the 90s, a new force known as alt country would begin to rise up. But in 1987, that term wasn't in fashion yet. In fact, one of the key bands of the time that would lead to the rise of the alt-country fan base was just forming in 1987, that band being Uncle Tupelo. But Uncle Tupelo wouldn't release their seminal debut album, No Depression, until 1990. Meanwhile, 1987 saw the second album come out for another important figure in the development of alt-country, that being the artist Steve Earle. Steve Earle had debuted the prior year with 1986's album, Guitar Town. Earle's 1987 sophomore album was titled Exit Zero, and it was his first album to be co-credited to his band, The Dukes. At this point, Steve Earle's country rock style still leaned pretty hard towards a fairly commercial style that could have conceivably got him some traction in Nashville.
I know I'm going way too fast. I've been down this road just searching for me. It don't go nowhere, just brings you back up.
It wouldn't be until the next year, 1988, when Steve Earle released his great album Copperhead Road, that he really started to chart his own unique musical directions. There was a new energy at the time going on in bluegrass music that would help to feed into the rise of a new generation of what has become known as newgrass or progressive bluegrass. Fiddle player and singer Alison Krauss, only 16 years old at the time, released her debut solo album in 1987, Too Late to Cry.
I wonder why he's not with me tonight. If the raven on tonight, then I won't sleep. I'm haunted by this loneliness I fear. And it's too late to cry, cause we left it all behind. Too late to cry, cause there's nothing left to find. You won't get more than you live on for, and it's too late to cry tonight.
Alison Krauss had not yet joined with her well-known band, Union Station. But on this debut album, she was supported by a fine studio band of bluegrass stars who Krauss had gotten to know because she had already, by this point, been playing professionally since she was 10 years old, just 2 years after first learning to play the fiddle. And she had already participated in the recording of a collaborative album back in 1985. The term newgrass that was applied to these new directions had been taken from the name of the band Newgrass Revival, which had been part of the early 70s hippie bluegrass movement. In 1987, Newgrass Revival was in the midst of its greatest commercial success, with banjo virtuoso Bella Fleck, a member of the band at the time, along with founder Sam Bush, and also Pat Flynn and John Cohen. Newgrass Revival's 1987 album, Hold to a Dream, contained two songs that wound up bubbling just a bit under the country top 40 charts, which was extremely good success for a bluegrass band.
I wonder why he's not with me tonight. If the raven on tonight, then I won't sleep. I'm haunted by this loneliness I fear. And it's too late to cry, cause we left it all behind. Too late to cry, cause there's nothing left to find. You won't get more than you live on for. And it's too late to cry.
Mainstream country music had been in a bit of a lull period, as the countrypolitan sounds that had dominated the genre since the success of the urban cowboy movie at the beginning of the decade was beginning to lose favor. Alabama was the dominant country stars of the 1980s, and they achieved another number one album in 1987 with their album Just Us. But while Alabama were still certainly popular and successful, they weren't quite as dominant anymore. Just Us would only spend 1 week at the number one spot.
Back when I was young and green, I was falling back then. But now I'm working on building a fire and flirting with that old desire and falling again into the wind. I fall in again.
Kenny Rogers had flourished during the 80s with a pop and easy listening friendly variety of country music. And Kenny Rogers was still popular, but no longer leading as well. Rogers' 1987 album, I Prefer the Moonlight, didn't sell very well for him, despite containing three country music top 10 songs, including a number one country hit with the song Make No Mistake, She's Mine, which was a duet with Ronnie Millsap.
Cause I don't want to close my eyes.
Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, who had started out their career in the 60s and the 70s as hippie outsiders, who the Nashville elite had been suspicious of, had by this time been fully embraced by country music fans. And during the mid-1980s, the band had gone on a great run of success with a number of big country radio hits. This included 3 top 10 country hits for the band off of their 1987 album, Hold On, including their number 1 country hit, Fishing in the Dark. Linda Ronstadt, Dolly Parton, and Emmylou Harris had collaborated on an album called Trio in 1987, which wound up spending 5 weeks as the number 1 country album and went to number 6 on the overall Billboard album charts. Trio included 4 singles that were all top 10 country hits, including the number 1 country hit for their cover of the old Phil Spector song, To Know Him Is to Love Him. Roseanne Cash had a great run of success during the 1980s, and that continued with her 1987 album, King's Record Store, an album which produced 4 number 1 country hits for Roseanne Cash. But despite that single success, King's Record Store itself topped out at number 6 on the country charts.
In a South Texas border town sat a boy and his guitar, and the people came from all around and all the girls from there to Austin were slipping away from home and putting jewelry in hock to take a trip to go and listen to the little dark-haired boy who played the Tennessee flat top box and he would play.
Meanwhile, Roseanne Cash's father, Johnny, was in the midst of a depressing run of irrelevance as a recording star, including his 1987 album, Johnny Cash is Coming to Town. This album was yet another poor seller, as most of Johnny Cash's albums were in the 1980s, and none of the 4 singles off of Johnny Cash is Coming to Town got any airplay at all. Nancy Griffith never broke out big as a country music star. She ultimately got embraced much more by the folk community and also became a major star in Ireland. But during the 1980s, Nancy Griffith wrote a number of songs that became hits for mainstream country music stars, as well as a few songs that became pop hits as well. Nancy's 1987 album, Lone Star State of Mind, wound up becoming her most successful, going to number 23 on the country charts, with the Lone Star State of Mind title track becoming her highest charting single, going to number 36 on the country song charts. Lone Star State of Mind also contained her original version of her song From a Distance, which wound up becoming a huge number 2 pop hit for Bette Midler, and has wound up going on to become a popular song standard for cover versions by other artists. Nancy Griffith's version of the song didn't really make an impact in America, although her version of the song did go to the top 10 in Ireland, where she had a strong fan base.
From a distance.
Townes Van Zandt had been a cult figure in country music, who became better known due to his songs becoming hits for other people than he was for his own recordings of his songs. Van Zandt's career was boosted in the 1980s due to the big success of his song Poncho and Lefty, which had become a number one country hit when it was covered by Willie Nelson and Merle Haggard. The success of that song had wound up getting Townes Van Zandt a new recording contract, and he released his 1987 album, At My Window, his first new album since 1978. But, much like his previous album work, At My Window wound up being critically acclaimed, and it wound up being mined by other artists for cover songs, but the album didn't sell well. So Van Zandt wound up once again finding himself without a recording contract.
If I had a buckskin stallion, I'd tame him down and ride away. And if I had a flying schooner, I'd sail into the light of day. If I had your love forever, sail into the light of day.
The momentum in country music in 1987 was with a number of artists that were pushing a more traditional country sound, especially Randy Travis, who released his album Always and Forever in 1987.
As long as old men sit and talk about the weather, as long as old women sit and talk about old men, if you wonder how long I'll be faithful, I'll be happy to tell you again. I'm gonna
Always and Forever became, at the time, the most successful country album of all time, with 43 non-consecutive weeks at number one on the country music charts, a record that has now been broken by three other artists. Shania Twain would break this record 10 years later with her album Come On Over in 1997, which spent 50 weeks at the number one spot on the country charts. And then Luke Combs would match Shania Twain's success in 2017 with 50 weeks at number one. And then most recently, Morgan Wallen has shattered this record with 97 weeks at the number one spot on the country charts during the last couple of years. The family band The Judds had achieved instant popularity after their first album came out in 1984. And that album and their two following albums in 1985 and 86 had all wound up topping the country charts. But in 1987, the only new album by the Judds was their album Christmas Time with the Judds, which didn't sell well initially when it came out and didn't wind up charting. But over time, due to the continued seasonal sales to country music fans looking for music during Christmas time, the music has wound up going on to achieve platinum sales status. Reba McEntire's career had struggled during the 70s and early 80s, but McEntire picked up major steam in the late 1980s with the rise of this new neo-traditionalist movement, which fit much better with Reba's performing style. Reba's 1987 album, The Last One I Know, went to number three on the country charts, and it became Reba's first album to hit the top 200 Billboard albums chart overall, though it did top out at only number 102 there. The Last One I Know wound up containing two songs that went to number one on the country songs charts for Reba.
Oh, why is the last one to know?
While artists like Randy Travis and Reba McEntire were trying to bring country music back to its roots and away from the pop crossover style that had dominated the earlier part of the decade, there was a movement as well, trying to pull country music back to a more honky-tonk feel. Dwight Yoakam released his second album in 1987, Hillbilly Deluxe. Like his 1986 album, Hillbilly Deluxe went to number one on the country music charts. And the album wound up containing four top 10 country singles for Yoakam. Yoakam's style was a throwback to the Bakersfield sound of the 1960s. And it was authentic enough at that that I personally gave Hillbilly Deluxe pretty serious consideration for a spot in my top 20 for the year. I do really like the early albums from Dwight Yoakam.
You've got your little way of hurting me, you know just how to tear me up, leave me in small pieces on the ground. You've got your little way.
Another second album in 1987 came out from Katie Lang and the Reclines. Unlike Dwight Yoakam, Katie Lang's debut album in 1984 hadn't really caught much attention. Her 1987 follow-up album, Angel with a Lariat, didn't really set sales charts on fire either. It only went to number 57 on the country album charts. But Angel with a Lariat did get rave reviews from music critics, and it helped Katie Lang to start to build the cult following that still supports her to this day. Besides Heartland Rock, the other major rock music trend of the time was in the genre often called hair metal, although the term hair metal has now come to be seen as a pejorative, so there are many fans of the style who prefer the name glam metal instead. By 1987, this genre was experiencing a new second wave of copycat bands, but the first wave bands were mostly still around selling lots of albums. Motley Crue had been one of the earliest hair metal bands to release an album, and they were still riding high in 1987 with the release of their fourth album, Girls, Girls, Girls. Girls, Girls, Girls would become Motley Crue's highest chart success to that point at number two, although that would wind up being surpassed just 2 years later when they released Dr. Feelgood, which became the band's only number one album. Girls, Girls, Girls wound up selling over 4 million copies, and the title song of the album became a number 12 pop hit for the band. Girls, Girls, Girls was kept out of the number one spot by the release of Whitney Houston's second album, Whitney. Motley Crue is one of the few hair metal bands that I personally enjoy listening to, and this album shows some of why that is. Mick Mars's guitar work is on prominent display here, and is one of the highlights of the band's music. But the band's songwriting was never very deep, so most of the band's deep-cut songs that don't manage to mix in the more pop-friendly hooks of their hits just aren't very good at all. And so the deep cuts on this album are just far too weak for the album to have ever been considered for a top 20 spot by me. One of the better hair metal albums of 1987 came from the British band Whitesnake. Whitesnake had begun releasing music back in 1978, and they had gained significant success in the UK, starting with their third album in 1980. But the band were being pretty well ignored by the US market. Whitesnake finally gained a little notice over here in 1984 after the release of their sixth album, Slide It In. Slide It In wound up selling 2 million copies, even though it topped out at only number 40 on the Billboard album charts over here. And their song Slow and Easy off of that album had become a mid-size hit on rock radio here. But Whitesnake absolutely finally broke through in 1987 when they released their self-titled seventh album. This album contained several songs that got heavy MTV play, and it contained the song Here I Go Again, which became a number one pop hit single for the band.
And here I go again.
Here I Go Again was a remake of a song that the band had originally released in 1982. The band followed up Here I Go Again with the song Is This Love, which went to number 2 on the pop charts. Two other songs on this album got a decent amount of play on rock radio as well. The Whitesnake album is excellently produced and full of accessible, well-executed commercial rock music, and the band singer David Coverdale was excellent, although it should be noted that Whitesnake's music at the time and since then was heavily criticized as being simply a watered-down version of the sound of Led Zeppelin. This view of Whitesnake wasn't really helped when lead singer David Coverdale later collaborated on music with Led Zeppelin's Jimmy Page. The band Great White began to capture the attention of American rock fans with their third album, Once Bitten, which was released in 1987 and contained two top 10 rock radio hits for the band. But it really wouldn't be until the band's next album came out in 1989 that they would achieve their pop radio crossover success.
Rock me! Rock me!
The band White Lion had their greatest success in 1987 with their album Pride. This album produced two top 10 pop hits for White Lion and a third song that had moderate success on rock radio.
So if you go away, I know that I will follow.
The UK band Slade had provided major inspiration to the American hair metal style, but the band had been pretty well ignored by the overall American public during their early 70s peak years. With several of the band's songs becoming hits in America in cover versions by American hair metal bands, Slade was able to get slightly more notice in America and wound up charting a couple of songs here in 1983 and 1984. But by 1987, Slade was back to being pretty well ignored in America. Their 1987 album, You Boys Make Big Noise, didn't chart over here at all. And to be fair, even in England, this album was pretty well ignored. And partially due to that failure, You Boys Make Big Noise wound up being the last album by Slade's original lineup. The American band Kiss had been another major influence on the American hair metal bands of the 1980s. And the band at the time was in the midst of their unmasked period, performing without their stereotypical monster makeup. 1987 had Kiss releasing their best chart success of the 1980s, with the platinum-level sales and the number 18 album ranking for their album Crazy Nights, although the singles from Crazy Nights got only minor airplay, barely scraping the bottom end of the rock top 40 charts.
But I don't hear the rap that they all say. They try to tell us we don't belong. That's alright, we're million strong. This is my music, it makes me proud. These are my people, and this is my crowd. These are crazy, 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 crazy nights.
Meanwhile, Kiss's former lead guitar player, Ace Frehley, released his first of two albums with his band Frehley's Comet. This 1987 self-titled album produced Ace Frehley's greatest success outside of Kiss, with a number 27 rock radio hit for his song Into the Night.
It's the evolution stand.
Twisted Sister had peaked as a band in 1984 and was in rapid decline by 1987. Twisted Sister's album, Love Is for Suckers, didn't sell well, and the best single from the album barely squeaked into the rock radio top 40. It would wind up being Twisted Sister's last studio album until they released a Christmas album in 2006. Dee Snider left the band after this album, and they were dropped from their recording contract, and the band broke up for a decade. The band Night Ranger wasn't being ignored yet, but the band was definitely in a period of diminishing returns by 1987. They had released two platinum-selling albums in 1983 and 1985, but the band's 1987 album Big Life only got to gold-level status, and only one song on that album got any rock radio play.
It's like the sound of electric guitar. Hearts collide and hearts will be broken. Over and over, it's the same every day. What can I say? Words never concern me.
The secret of my success is I'm living.
The following year, the band would release an album that sold even worse, and the band began to fall apart after that. Faster Pussycat put out their self-titled debut album in 1987, though the album was pretty well ignored. The band would gain some short-term success with their second album 2 years later. The band Wasp never really had any singles success in America, despite a long string of hit songs over in the UK. In 1987, Wasp released a live album, Live in the Raw, which was the first appearance for the band's song Harder, Faster, which wound up being the band's response to their fight against censorship attempts by the PMRC. The band Y&T only had minor commercial success during the 1980s, but they gained a pretty loyal cult following among metal and hard rock fans. Y&T went all out to try and gain some crossover pop success in 1987 on their album Contagious. The band brought in outside songwriters, including Taylor Rhodes, who had written hit songs for Aerosmith and also for Celine Dion. However, the only single released from Contagious didn't wind up making the rock radio top 40, and the album itself wound up topping out at only number 78 on the Billboard charts. Additional, less notable albums that I would classify in the hair metal genre that I listened to for this project included the self-titled debut album by British guitar player Kane Roberts, who was better known for his work with Alice Cooper, the fourth album by American band Keel, which was a self-titled album, the American band Lion, which is not to be confused with White Lion, who I just recently mentioned. Lion was a band that had made their first recordings as part of movie soundtracks in prior years, and in 1987, they released their debut full-length studio album after an EP was released by the band in 1986. But this debut album made no impact. Macaulay Schenker Group was a new home for Michael Schenker, and 1987 was when the band's debut album, Perfect Timing, was released, with music styled to try and appeal to the hair metal fans. But it didn't really work out, with the album barely squeaking into the top 100, and the only single off the album just notching in at number 40 on the rock radio charts. TNT was a Norwegian band that started out in a more straightforward heavy metal style, but their 1987 album, Tell No Tales, definitely sounds like the band was trying to appeal to that hair metal audience. It's possible the band was trying to gain a bigger American audience, but it never really developed for the band. None of the songs on the album got any play in the US, and the album itself only got to number 100 on the American charts.
Just a kid on a highway.
The big sonic boom in 1987 was from the debut album from Guns N' Roses. Guns N' Roses so quickly transcended the hair metal genre that it is now considered fairly controversial to try and lump the band in to the hair metal description. But just one look at the band's first music video, with the image of Axl Rose getting off the bus with his big teased up glam metal hair and makeup, definitely shows exactly who the band was aiming at with their initial marketing, before trying to abandon that image for a more straightforward, hard-edged rock image, after their music slowly elevated them to become the biggest band in the United States over the next year. Appetite for Destruction stands as the best-selling debut album of all time, and the number 7 best-selling album in U.S. history. 3 songs off of Appetite for Destruction achieved top 10 pop hit status, with the song Sweet Child of Mine going to number 1. I personally don't hate Guns N' Roses, but I also never really bought into the hype either. I think they were a very skilled band who unfortunately let their egos very quickly get in the way of their music. I like the song Paradise City best off of their debut album, so let's go ahead and use that for the musical segment here. Here's Paradise City by Guns N' Roses. Enjoy! The commercial success of hair metal had opened the door for a lot of hard rock music in general that didn't necessarily fit the genre stereotypes that defined hair metal. Though, as in many cases in music history, sometimes the dividing lines between subgenres can be pretty narrow and fluid. Def Leppard was one of the most successful bands of the 1980s, but through their career, they had refused to be restricted by genre labels. Early in Def Leppard's career, they had made music that was fairly well in line with a lot of other bands in the new wave of British heavy metal. But even in those days, Def Leppard's influences were more heavily tilted towards 70s British glam bands than they were towards the sound of a band like Black Sabbath. After that start, Def Leppard went on to be one of the bands that broke through to big pop crossover success in 1983, setting the stage, along with Quiet Riot, for what would become the rise of hair metal. In 1987, Def Leppard would release their biggest-selling album of all time, Hysteria. Hysteria wound up selling over 20 million copies. And the album would release a string of hugely successful singles by the band. Seven of the songs off Hysteria were released as singles, and all seven of these made significant impacts on the rock radio charts. And six of those songs crossed over to pop chart success as well, including four of the songs hitting the top 10, and one of the songs becoming a number one pop hit, Love Bites. Though I would say that it was their number two pop hit, Pour Some Sugar on Me, which has gone on to be the much more well-remembered hit. For the album Hysteria, Def Leppard largely abandoned their remaining metal influences and embraced the opportunity to just be a loud, hard-rocking pop band. Like the band's prior two albums, the production on Hysteria was meticulously fussed over by Mutt Lang. For me, while I find that Hysteria is certainly full of accessible earworm-style songs, I personally always felt that the band had pushed a bit too far into the pop realm. I will always personally prefer the album Pyromania, which to me is the perfect balance of hard-rocking gravitas and pop tunefulness. Alice Cooper's glam-adjacent shock rock style of the 1970s had been another big influence on the 80s generation of hair metal bands. So it would have seemed logical for Alice Cooper to try and hop onto that trend during the 1980s to achieve some renewed commercial success. But instead, Alice Cooper was spending the decade doubling down on his shock rock image, making music that was inspired by the slasher film movie fads of the time. And this direction included Alice Cooper's 1987 album, Raise Your Fist and Yell. Cooper's tour in support of this album wound up becoming infamous for its graphic, simulated, horror film-style violent theatrics. Raise Your Fist and Yell didn't really do anything to make Cooper commercially relevant again. The album ultimately topped out at only number 73 on the album charts, and the one single that was released from the album received no airplay.
'Cause I never walk away
Sammy Hagar was riding high in the late 1980s, having taken over the lead singer position in Van Halen and helping to lead that band to a much more consistent pop success than the band had ever achieved with David Lee Roth. Sammy Hagar released a new solo album in the midst of that success in 1987. This solo album was initially self-titled as simply Sammy Hagar, but the album was later renamed to I Never Said Goodbye, in order to differentiate the album from the 1977 self-titled album that Sammy Hagar had previously released. There was a fan contest for this renaming ceremony, although the copy of this album that I personally owned in 1987 was simply the self-titled version. An interesting note is that Eddie Van Halen plays on this album, but he plays mostly bass guitar. He has only one song on the album on which he contributed an actual lead guitar part. This Sammy Hagar album was a commercial success, but certainly not anywhere near the level of the success that he was having with Van Halen. Nor was the album as big as a couple of Sammy Hagar's pre-Van Halen solo albums had been. I Never Said Goodbye wound up going to number 14 on the Billboard album charts, and it achieved gold-level sales status. There was one major hit off of the album, Give to Live, which went to number 1 on rock radio and number 23 on the pop charts. And there were three additional songs from the album that were also mid-level hits on rock radio. '70s rock stars Aerosmith began a major career comeback in 1987 with their latest new album, Permanent Vacation. Aerosmith had been reintroduced to a new generation of listeners the prior year when the rap band Run DMC had achieved the number 4 pop hit with their rap cover version of Aerosmith's old 70s hit, Walk This Way. Aerosmith rode the momentum of that renewed interest with their first single off of Permanent Vacation, the song Dude Looks Like a Lady. This song would become Aerosmith's first pop chart hit since 1978, and the song went to number 14 on the pop charts. Two more songs off of Permanent Vacation also achieved pop success, including a number 3 pop chart ranking for the song Angel, which was the highest charting single for Aerosmith to that point in their career, and the second highest of their overall career, with the band achieving a number 1 song about a decade after this. Permanent Vacation went quintuple platinum, but that great success would actually be surpassed by each of Aerosmith's next two albums. It was a remarkable comeback story for a band that had pretty well imploded before this due to their drug abuse.
Backstage, we're having the time.
Deep Purple was another 1970s superstar band that was still making music in the 1980s. But Deep Purple's 1987 album did nothing to bring back that band to relevance. The House of Blue Light did not even achieve gold-level sales status, and the three singles released off the album were all pretty well ignored by radio on both sides of the Atlantic. One of the more interesting hard rock releases of 1987 came from guitar virtuoso Joe Satriani. Satriani made guitar-centered, melodic, instrumental rock music. The guitar player had released his debut album the prior year, 1986's album Not of This Earth. That album had been largely self-funded, and while it was embraced by music critics, it didn't sell at all, forcing Joe Satriani to take a gig touring as the guitar player for Greg Kinn and also singing background vocals on the Crowded House debut album in order to help pay off his credit card bills. But Satriani's follow-up album in 1987 achieved incredible success for an album of instrumental-only music at a time when instrumental rock was not really in vogue. Surfing with the Alien achieved platinum-level sales, and it hit number 29 on the Billboard album charts. Two of the songs off of Surfing with the Alien achieved moderate hit status on rock radio, with the bigger of these two songs being the song Satch Boogie, which went to number 22 on the rock charts and can still often be heard on classic rock radio. The Canadian band Triumph was in decline in 1987 when they released their album Surveillance. Surveillance shows some of the musical conflict that was going on. When you listen to the album, there's an internal conflict between the prog rock guitar approach that guitar player Rick Emmett was featuring over the top of fairly conventional blues rock foundations by the band's rhythm section. And this conflict in directions by the band would wind up ultimately fracturing them during the tour that they did in support of this album. And Rick Emmett wound up leaving the band at the end of the tour. Dokken delivered their most successful album of their career in 1987. It was their fourth career album, titled Back for the Attack. This album featured the most focused music of Dokken's career, which likely is part of what led to its greater success. Back for the Attack achieved a number 13 ranking on the Billboard album charts, and it achieved platinum-level sales. Three of the five singles from this album hit the rock charts. Though it should be noted that all three of these hits, like all of Dokken's hits, were only moderate-level hits, the highest charting song off this album being a number 20 ranking for the song Burning Like a Flame. Other lesser-known hard rock bands that I listened to for this project included the Canadian rock band Helix. Helix never really broke through in the U.S. markets, and their 1987 album was Wild in the Streets. The English rock band Magnum released a compilation album in 1987 titled Mirador. This album was an attempt to introduce the band to an American audience, but the effort was not a success, and the band never made any inroads into America. Another instrumental guitar rock musician was Tony McAlpine. And like Joe Satriani, McAlpine had his greatest commercial success in 1987. But in the case of McAlpine, that so-called success was only an achievement of a number 146 ranking on the Billboard album charts for his album Maximum Security. Grunge music, of course, would become the major force in hard rock music during the early 1990s, but the seeds of that new style were being planted in 1987. The debut release from Pixies came out in 1987, Come On Pilgrim. It's a great release, but it's only a 20-minute long EP rather than a full album, so I didn't give it any consideration for a spot in my list, since I do not consider EPs to be albums. Soundgarden also released their debut recording in 1987. And like Pixies, Soundgarden started out their career with an EP. Soundgarden's EP was titled Screaming Life, and this release definitely shows why Soundgarden is considered one of the pioneers of the grunge sound. The Pacific Northwest grunge pioneers Melvins released their debut album in 1987. The Melvins were known for a sort of Black Sabbath-influenced type of sludge metal sound that was definitely a major influence on the development of grunge in the area. And the band's debut album in 1987 was titled Gluey Porch Treatments. Another Northwest band, Screaming Trees, released their second album in 1987, titled Even If and Especially When. But at this point in Screaming Trees' career, the band was much more of a neo-psychedelic garage rock band than the stereotypical sludge rock sound that typified the grunge sound that was to come.
If you pass me in the square, just pretend that I'm not there. Just reach over into my pocket, take the paper and written on it. What to do? It's up to you. Transfiguration.
The most difficult hard rock album cut I made for 1987 came from the English band The Cult. The Cult was a band that combined an excellent riff-oriented blues rock sound that calls to mind AC/DC's chugging music, and combined that with a lead singer that sounded at times like a less depressed reincarnation of Jim Morrison. The Cult had gained success in the UK with their 1985 second album, titled Love, and the band would spread that success to the United States in 1987 with their third album, titled Electric. The highlight of Electric was their hit song, Love Removal Machine, which went to number 15 on the rock charts. The songs Little Devil and Wildflower were also minor rock radio hits. But beyond those songs, the deep cuts on Electric are almost all entertaining, full of equally good guitar riffs and driving rhythms, and great vocal work. This album got heavy consideration for a spot in my top 20, although ultimately I did cut it, but as I said, it was a very difficult cut for me. Let's go ahead and listen to the song Love Removal Machine now. Enjoy! In opposition to the commercial-friendly focus of hair metal was the growth of more extreme versions of heavy metal, with the trend having been kicked off with the thrash metal bands that began appearing earlier in the decade. Thrash metal melded the technical precision of metal music, but was influenced by punk rock to pump up the tempos and the aggression of the music. The big four bands that are largely credited with pioneering thrash metal are Metallica, Megadeth, Slayer, and Anthrax. Only Metallica and Anthrax of those four had new releases out in 1987, and the Metallica album was just an EP of cover songs. So the most important thrash album of 1987 came out from Anthrax. Anthrax released their third album in 1987, titled Among the Living. Among the Living was dedicated to Metallica bass player Cliff Burton. Burton had died in a bus accident in 1986, while Anthrax was opening for Metallica on tour. The album Among the Living was embraced by metal fans and by music critics, and the album elevated Anthrax to arena-level status, making them among one of the most important metal bands of the era. Additional metal thrash bands that released albums in 1987 included the band Exodus, who released Pleasures of the Flesh, their second album, and the first one to feature their new singer, Steve Souza. The band Overkill released their second album as well, Taking Over. And the band Testament released their debut album in 1987, The Legacy. While the Brazilian metal band Sepultura released their second album in 1987, Schizophrenia. Genre was being greatly embraced in Germany, and 1987 brought out new albums from the band Creator with their third album, Terrible Certainty. The band Destruction released their third album as well, titled Release from Agony. Sodom released their second album, Persecution Mania, and the band Tankard released their second album, Chemical Invasion. These four bands are all considered the four cornerstones of thrash metal music in Germany.
Desire, or is it you superior? Acting on those, waiting to walk, waiting to fall, the thump down for the end. The arena is the path, the crowd awaits, strength to living the alone. Come down with you, we're just dreaming of your mind, what's the list of life, with the good strength, the miracle. But it's been suffering as you set this game, you're left without your miracle.
Canadian metal band Voivod released their third album in 1987, Killing Technology. The band added elements of prog rock to their initial thrash style for this album. And a debut album in the thrash style in 1987 came from California band Death Angel, who released The Ultra Violence in 1987. There can be a bit of a fluid dividing line with some bands between thrash metal and thrash punk. And one band at the time that was very much straddling that line, with a foot in both worlds, was the band Napalm Death. Napalm Death released their debut album in 1987, titled Scum, with the two sides of the album seeming to give a nod in the direction of both the punk and the metal camps. But it should be noted that part of the reason for this difference in sound was that the two sides of this debut album had a complete change in the band lineup during the year plus that it had taken to complete this album, and only the drummer remained unchanged from side A to side B. The next phase in the continued splintering and quest for extreme new directions was developing in 1987 with the rise of black metal. The English band Venom had helped to give this subgenre its name with the title of their 1982 album, Black Metal. And Venom were still leading the way in this style in 1987 with the release of their fifth album, Calm Before the Storm.
Welcome back!
Bathory was a Swedish metal band, and they released their third album in 1987, Under the Sign of the Black Mark. A Swiss band, Celtic Frost, released their third album, titled Into the Pandemonium, in 1987. And Norwegian band Mayhem released their debut EP in 1987, titled Death Crush. This EP was hugely influential, but Mayhem were a band that took the whole devil-worshipping thing way too seriously, and the band even wound up getting involved in burning churches in Norway. The band was going through extreme lineup changes during the late 80s, and this kept them from following up this EP until 1994, by which time the band had actually disbanded just before the release of that album. After suffering through the suicide of one member a few years before, and then the murder of a second member of the band who was killed by a former bandmate. Beyond even the heaviness of black metal was the newly emerging subgenre of death metal, with the Florida band Death debuting in 1987 with their album Scream Bloody Gore.
First of all, I
The sludgy subgenre of doom metal was bubbling under through the 80s, and in 1987, that subgenre was represented with the second album from the Swedish band Candlemass. The more standard mainstream metal music was still very much thriving as well, with a huge number of releases in 1987 to sort through. The biggest album of the year in metal music was credited to Ozzy Osbourne and Randy Rhoads, and the album was titled Tribute. Tribute was a live album released as a memorial to guitar player Randy Rhoads, who had died in a plane crash in 1982. Tribute is an excellent document of Randy Rhoads' guitar prowess, but I personally think that a lot of the tracks on this album have pretty poor sound quality, and I think this is because tapes of those live shows hadn't actually been produced by the sort of high-quality recording equipment that would be used for most deliberate live albums.
Maybe, yeah, yeah, it's not too late.
Meanwhile, Ozzy's old band Black Sabbath was struggling at this point. Sabbath released The Eternal Idol in 1987, which featured yet another change at the lead singer spot, now featuring Tony Martin on vocals. The album would be the band's worst-selling album to that point, though they had not yet hit rock bottom. Ronnie James Dio had spent a renowned but short stint in Black Sabbath earlier in the decade. But Ronnie James Dio was now leading his own band called Simply Dio. Dio released their fourth album in 1987, Dream Evil, which to me sounds pretty well in line with the band's previous albums. But for some reason, Dio's audience completely abandoned him at this point. The first two Dio albums had been platinum sellers for the band, and their third album had gone gold. But this fourth album, Dream Evil, the sales plummeted by 90% from their prior album, and the band's album sales after that point never really recovered. Ronnie James Dio is treated now pretty much like a metalhead saint since his death, so the complete collapse of his actual commercial fortunes at this point in his career still seems pretty weird to me. Certainly the band was doing nothing to try and appeal to the hair metal fans, nor was it adapting its style to try and appeal to the new upcoming thrash metal sound. So maybe that's why Dio's album sales plummeted so shockingly at this time. Maybe their music was simply being seen as passé. If any major metalhead listeners have any more background info to offer on this subject, or their own conjectures for this decline in commercial sales for Dio, please feel free to drop me a line. Metal pioneers Judas Priest released their second live album in 1987. And this album didn't initially sell well for the band, but slowly over time, it has at least achieved gold-level sales status, though it took a couple decades to get there. The album is taken from the band's 1986 tour, and it features no songs from any of the band's 1970s-era albums. All the songs on this live album are from the 80s. Motorhead's early albums had been sort of a precursor to the rise of thrash metal, as Motorhead had been really the first metal band to fully embrace punk rock as a part of its influences. Motorhead released the album Rock and Roll in 1987, and the album featured the return of Filthy Animal Taylor on drums. But despite having the classic lineup of the band back together, Rock and Roll sold poorly for Motorhead, and it continued their commercial slide that the band was suffering through most of the late 80s.
Get a sweet thing on the side, home cooking on the side. Side order could be a daughter, and you're looking good. Come on, baby, eat the rich, put the bite on the son of a bitch. Don't mess up, don't you give me no switch. Come on, baby.
Other major metal albums that I reviewed included the seventh album from Japanese band Loudness, titled Hurricane Eyes, the third full-length album from Lizzie Borden, titled Visual Lies, the second album from King Diamond, Abigail, which was King Diamond's best-selling album of their career, the third album from Grim Reaper, Rock You to Hell, the fourth album from Anvil, Strength of Steel, and the second full-length album from Helloween, which was the first part of an epic prog metal project by the band titled Keeper of the Seven Keys, with their 1987 album being part one of that epic, and the second part of that epic being released as a separate album the following year.
If you're out there all alone, and you don't know where to go to, come and take a trip with me to future world.
Additional lower-tier metal albums that I reviewed also included the sixth album from the American band Manila Road, the self-titled debut album from Italian band Dark Quarterer, the third full-length album from Armored Saint, Raising Fear, and the debut album from Cacophony, which was titled Speed Metal Symphony. And while the playing of Cacophony on this album is indeed pretty fast guitar shredding, it did not really qualify to be categorized into the emerging thrash subgenre to me, since rather than the band having any punk influences to it at all, Cacophony was one of those metal bands that had a very classical music influence to their musical style. This song is going to end this episode of Road to Jam Nation. Please join me again next week, when I will continue my review of the albums of 1987, getting into some of the more commercial rock releases, as well as the various forms of alternative rock that were being released at the time. I hope you're enjoying this, and I hope you'll be back. As always, if you have any comments, criticisms, complaints, or just want to say hi, you can send email to tony@roadtojamnation.com. Or you can join my public Facebook group, also titled Road to Jam Nation. Or you can find me on Twitter under my actual name, Tony Kirillik. Thanks for listening.